Right now, though, it is not up in the air. It is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Arthur joins us every Monday morning at this time. We rebroadcast it also right after our noontime news segment during the week, and also on the weekends as well, and also on demand at robinhoodradio.com on demand. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. I don't know why we're laughing. There's so much going on in the world that makes me anxious.
That's why you've got to laugh.
So this is probably why I have lately turned to baking. Baking requires some precision, so you have to concentrate, and it gets your mind off of whatever else is happening in your life, actually. And it's sort of like fun to look forward to, and like, what am I going to bake today? Now, I get that from an old, literally very old friend. She died, it could be 10 years ago, in her 90s. And one day somebody said to her at the table, you know, what keeps you going? And she says, I wake up every morning thinking, what should I bake today? And until life became too much to bear, and she tuned out and died, she did that. And every day she baked something. And we always wondered what happened. She was a slim woman. She didn't eat it. That was for sure. And now I understand. I give it to the doorman, or two doormen, or my next-door neighbor. Because, you know, as I've mentioned on the air before, I'm sort of fixated on perfecting a bran muffin recipe. And so I've been making bran muffins pretty regularly. And who can eat all these bran muffins, especially the ones that aren't the way I want them to be? When I finally get to a recipe that is what I consider perfection, I will share it with everybody. In the meantime, this is still a work in progress. But my neighbor, Ellen, is enjoying the results. I pawn some of these muffins off on her, and we've taken to eating them for dessert. I figure, you know, with all that fiber, at least it's something healthy, and that's not too sweet either. Anyway, but back to baking. So it's apple season, and it didn't even dawn on me how much I must love apple cake until a listener wrote to me and said she was looking for my apple walnut cake. It's a bundt cake, and it's in my Jewish cookbook as parv, which means it's neither dairy nor meat based. And obviously, there's no meat in a cake, but there's no dairy in this, and that it's an oil based cake. There's no butter. It's not vegan. There are eggs, I noticed a lot of products that used to not be labeled vegan are now being labeled vegan, and it's because they are kosher and parv, like this cake, except that it would have no eggs. Anyway, back to apple cake. So the listener wrote to me, and I sent her a copy of the recipe as it appears in Jewish Home Cooking, which is still, by the way, sold all over and most easily bought through Amazon. Anyway, Jewish Home Cooking, I perfected a recipe that is in my first cookbook, Cooking in a Small Kitchen. And the reason it ended up in Cooking in a Small Kitchen is that it was back then, we're talking about in the 1970s, I didn't really know how to mix a cake. And this was a recipe given to me by a friend whose aunt made it all the time. I think she called it German apple cake. And it was just one of these things. You throw everything in the bowl and you mix it. But in fact, that's not the best way to prepare this cake. And I had it in the cookbook. I enjoyed the cake as it was in the cookbook. But it was mainly there because it was a one-bowl cake and this was cooking in a small kitchen. So years later, I decided, you know, I always liked that cake, sort of. It was a little heavy, but let me try it now that I know how to bake. And I looked at the recipe. I realized, you know, the mixing directions were wrong. All the ingredients were right. And now I make this cake all the time. I love this cake. Everybody loves this cake. And the listener who asked me for the recipe did make the cake and wrote back to me that it disappeared very quickly. It's one of those cakes. And it also, by the way, doesn't have to disappear very quickly because it holds up so well. I mean, several days. I once kept it so long the apples started getting moldy, but the cake was itself around the apples was still delicious. Now, this is actually, it does call. Somebody I was talking to about this yesterday said, oh, but that cake calls for matzah cake meal. But I have another one I could have sworn that did not have matzah cake meal. I'm looking at it now. But another apple cake, I mean, I have so many, it looks like almost every book I wrote had an apple cake. and it's something that never dawned on me. So another apple cake that I actually went out and bought a special pan to bake. It's a 12-inch round baking pan, and it does bake best in the 12-inch round baking pan. But if you don't have a 12-inch round baking pan, and almost no American does, because I got this recipe from a friend who lives in Sicily, you can use a 13-by-9-inch Pyrex baking dish. And so this is the recipe I'm going to give you today, because this is a real of-the-moment recipe, meaning with apples being as there's something wrong. I'm looking at the recipe as it appears in my computer, and it's actually missing the apples. So that's not a good thing. Let me get another version of this, or I'll have to give you some other apple cake today. Here's Franca's apple cake. So Franca Micheli is my friend. And she makes this at the last minute. So here's the original recipe. Let me go look in my book. Do we have time?
Yes. Yes. Of course we do.
Nothing but time. the one that appears in the book should. This is in the Southern Italian Table. I do cook the recipes in my books. Sometimes I don't look at the recipes. If it was an apple cake, I certainly would have to look at the recipe, unless it was a cake I bake all the time. I don't bake this all the time. I used to bake it a lot, but I've given up on I gave up on baking for a while. And this is, as I said, Franca makes this, sort of lets us bake while we're eating our meal. And then when the meal is all over, she finishes it off, and we eat it warm. And I must say, it is best warm. It's a kind of homey cake, you know, that Italians bake at home, because they actually still have, as we used to here in Brooklyn anyway, or in New York City, a bakery on every corner. And you may have three bakeries in your neighborhood. Each one may have a different specialty. And so you would more likely go down to the bakery and buy the specialty than bake something yourself. I find this is funny, but I think the most common home dessert, at least in the south of Italy, but I wouldn't doubt the north also, is baked apples. When I was, you know, roaming Italy collecting recipes for my Italian books and learning from home cooks, I would ask, you know, what desserts they made, and, you know, a few custards and puddings, but almost everybody baked apples, as I do. And from now until spring, I'll be baking apples. So this is a buttery cake. It calls for 1 3/4 sticks of butter altogether. I'm just going to read ingredients. It's hard to do a baking recipe on the radio, I got to say. So I have to repeat things. So here the dry ingredients are 1/2 cup of fine, dry breadcrumbs. These are like the ones you buy in the supermarket, but without flavor. You know, the ones with just plain.
4C
but
plain.
I make my own breadcrumbs from stale bread, so I know what's in them. But you need these crumbs basically to line the pan. So you use about 2 tablespoons of the butter to butter either a 12-inch cake pan. As I said, I went out and bought one of these just so I could make this cake. I liked it so much when I was working on this book, I made it all the time. Or a 13-by-9-inch Pyrex, which is your standard Pyrex dish. And put the pan in the oven with the 2 tablespoons of butter in a 375 oven. And when the butter has melted, remove the pan from the oven. Of course, use your oven mitts or whatever. Brush the butter around the bottom and sides of the pan with a pastry brush. And then pour the breadcrumbs. This is a half a cup of fine, dry breadcrumbs into the pan and shake the pan to spread all the crumbs and the sides and coat the whole pan. That's it. Now, the dry ingredients for the batter are 2.5 cups of all-purpose flour. I always measure my flour by spooning it into the cup and leveling the cup. So 2.5 cups of all-purpose flour. Every baked good, even though it's sweet, should have salt. 1/4 teaspoon of salt. 1 tablespoon of baking powder. And you mix those dry ingredients together, flour, salt, and baking powder. As I give all these measurements, I have to laugh to myself because I remember when Franca gave me the recipe, not only did she give me the ingredients in metric, but also measurements using a plastic cup. And of course, I had to take one of the plastic cups to measure it. This was a 6-ounce cup, and that's how I got these measurements. It's like when, in the old days, women my grandmother's age, meaning having women, my grandmother was American-born, but even foreign-born, who were born around the turn of the century, they used memorial candle glasses, Yahrzeit glasses. Yahrzeit is...
I remember that, yeah.
Remember that?
Sure.
They use the Yahrzeit is a Yiddish word for memorial. So these are the candles that you light when it's the anniversary of a parent or sibling's death.
And I remember saying, where'd you get that?
You throw away this nice, perfectly nice glass that the candle came in.
Exactly.
And they were used as measuring cups. 1 Yahrzeit glass, 1/2 Yahrzeit glass. My grandmother, even though she was American-born, measured like that, but she also, you know, just eyeballed it all, too. But I have, when I was writing my Jewish cookbook, somebody wrote to me and said, that bring back such a when you talked about Yahrzeit on the radio, it brought back such memories. But did you know they've changed the size of Yahrzeit glasses because candle technology has improved, and you don't need as much candle in the glass as you used to burn for 24 hours.
Which makes total sense.
So what do I do now? Because a Yahrzeit glass is not a Yahrzeit glass anymore. So anyway, back to Franca's cake. So 3/4 cup of milk, 3 eggs, 1 cup of sugar, and you want to combine a stick of butter with the 3/4 cup of milk, heat it until the butter's melted, remove that from the heat, beat the 3 eggs in a large bowl. I use a whisk. I don't use an electric mixer. But I have very fond memories of watching Franca use her electric mixer, and I'll get to that in a second. So you beat the eggs, and then gradually beat in 3/4 cup of the sugar, and keep beating until the mixture's thick, foamy, light yellow. That's a very standard mixing technique. And then pour in the combination of milk and melted butter, and keep beating until it's well incorporated, and then... this is Sicily. Beat in 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil. Then the grated zest of a lemon. This is going to taste very good. And some vanilla. Now, of course, in Italy, they don't have vanilla extra. They must have it, but I never see it. People use vanilla powder. But I translated this to 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract. So it's a batter. And once you have made the batter... you haven't added the dry ingredients, but you're going to add the dry ingredients to the wet ingredients, and then stir in with your whisk, or if you're using an electric beater, this is what Franca does. She turns off the electric mixer, we're talking about a handheld mixer, and uses the beaters, continuing to use the beaters to stir in the dry ingredients. The thing is, you don't want to beat in, really, with an electric mixer the dry ingredients, it's going to make the batter, a tough cake. Scrape that batter, all made now, into the big pan, either the 12-inch cake pan or your 13-by-9-inch, and top it off with apples, peeled, cored, halved, cut into quarter-inch slices. You're going to need about 5 cups. It's a lot of apples. And you scatter those over the surface and let them sink in, and thinly slice the rest of your butter. You're going to have a lot more butter, about 4 tablespoons of butter, and put that on the top of the cake. Now bake it in this 375-degree oven for a half an hour. The batter will rise and will brown slightly, but you do want a nice browned surface. So if it doesn't brown to your liking after a half an hour at 375, and mine rarely does, I have to say, I stick it under the broiler for just a couple of minutes. Of course, if you're using a Pyrex dish, be careful, because Pyrex is not meant to go under the broiler, but you can get away with it for a couple of minutes. And that's it. And you can serve this hot. As I said, Franca lets it bake while we're eating lunch, really, not dinner, meaning a midday meal. And then she serves it hot. But believe me, it's very, very, very good warm. And it's also excellent even at room temperature, but not the next day. So I can't wait to make that. There's another apple cake, a new one that I found in a magazine that I'm dying to make, too. So I don't know. Apple cake, it's the season for it. So what can I say?
It's the season for it.
Yeah. So this week, however, I know that this is on Jill's mind, because we talked about it a couple weeks ago, about what pasta to use with what sauce. And Italians don't have any, well, they do have some firm rules about this. But really what it boils down to, no pun intended, is what pasta will integrate with what condimento, with what seasoning, with what sauce you're going to use. And the dilemma came up just the other day with me, because I was craving, I know this is a funny thing to crave, but I was craving greens. So I bought myself a big bunch of collards, and I was tempted to make them, as I used to, in sort of a mock barbecue style, using smoked turkey wings. I would make a broth with the smoked turkey wings and just, let's say, an onion, a whole onion cut into, and a clove stuck in it, and just boil that until you get a nice smoky broth, and then cook the collard greens in it. However, at the last minute, I realized I had a little carrot to use up, one little carrot. So looked so sad in the drawer. And one rib of celery. And so I made an Italian battuta, in French a mirepoix, and I'm not sure what you call it in English, but carrot, onion, celery, minced fine. And I sautéed that in some olive oil until the vegetables were tender. And then I added the collard greens, which I had boiled. By the way, when I prep collard greens, I get rid of the stems. I suppose you could use the stems separately, but they do take a lot longer to get tender than the leaves do. And I was craving was leaves, not stems. So I tossed the stems. But next time I do this, I'm probably going to save the stems and try doing something with them. But in any case, I boiled the leaves. They take a good 15 to 20 minutes to get tender, you know, big old collard greens. If you're using other greens, and any greens will do for this pasta, I would love Swiss chard, beet greens. If you buy beets with the greens attached, here's a way to use up the beet greens. You could even do this with cabbage. But I was looking for dark green greens. So kale, but kale takes a while to cook too. So boil it first, I think, is how to do it. And then I cut the collard greens into strips, just, you know, I sliced across the whole bunch of already boiled greens, and I put those strips in with the vegetables. And, you know, from there, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I thought we might just eat this as a vegetable, tossed with the carrot, onion, celery, and some olive oil, of course, salt and pepper. If you wanted, you could use hot red pepper. I didn't. I used black pepper. And I wasn't sure what to do. And then at the last minute, I said, you know, I'm getting lazy here. Why don't I just boil up some pasta, and we'll have greens and pasta. But what pasta? So I looked in the cupboard to see what I had. And I thought, well, I don't want spaghetti. Spaghetti is for a more liquid sauce or a creamy sauce, you know, something that will coat the pasta, like a tomato sauce, the standard, the typical tomatoes, you know, sauce on spaghetti, whether it's just a plain tomato sauce or amatriciana or something like carbonara, which is basically egg and cheese to coat the pasta, is very good with long pastas. I thought this was actually a macaroni dish, but I had some opened rigatoni, but too much. I only wanted 6 ounces of pasta, and I had 10 ounces of rigatoni and 4 ounces left over. That's an awkward amount. So I went on to the open peg of orecchiette, and I also had too much orecchiette for this dish, and that then would be not enough for another dish. So finally I decided, on sale not that long ago, I bought several boxes of bucatini, DiCecco bucatini. And I thought, all right, I'm going to break up the bucatini. And it ended up to be perfect because the collard greens were cut into long strands, and I broke the bucatini into, let's say, 4-inch pieces, meaning I broke my 6 ounces of pasta into thirds, so each piece was a third of a long strand. A bucatini, of course, is a kind of macaroni, but it's a long, like spaghetti, but it has a hole in the middle. It's a little chewier. It's a little more substantial than most spaghetti. And the size was going to integrate well with the collard greens, which it did. I was able to mix this up so that, you know, there was like a real dish altogether. It really mixed very well. And that's the goal here, is something that mixes well with the seasoning you're going to use. And that's why when I do vegetables with pasta, I'm often going to a macaroni rather than a long pasta. Does that make sense?
Yes. And
all that said, I have to...
escarole.
I'm now thinking and laughing to myself. In Rome these days, even though the classic amatriciana is on bucatini or spaghetti, a long pasta, because it's a kind of tomato sauce, and carbonara is usually on a long pasta, in Rome these days, businessmen at lunch do not eat long pasta. They want everything on a, like, rigatoni or penne or ziti, something they can stab with a fork, and it's not going to get
all over
their
ties, right? Their shirts are tight.
And in fact, you see, I don't know, I haven't seen this in a while, because men are not wearing, well, in Rome,
depends,
still wear ties.
Yeah.
But everybody used to put their tie over their shoulder.
I remember the first time I saw
eating.
That.
Remember
exactly.
That?
Yeah, it's like, what is this?
Yeah, because the real pastas were messy.
Right.
By the way, so we have a wonderful, wonderful ramen shop here in Park Slope in Brooklyn. I mean, they're all over the place. New York City has gone ramen crazy. I think maybe the trend is dying down. But we love this place. And I always would, you know, after I learned my lesson a couple times, would always wear a dark shirt that was not going to show my dripping from the ramen. And I always have a ramen with a little hot pepper in it, so it could be red. So one day when I... was particularly sloppy. The waitress, whose name is Sonia, she's our good friend now, she said, you know, in Japan, everybody wears a bib when they eat ramen. I mean, we have bibs, and they have paper bibs at the ramen shop.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, we're the only ones in this place wearing them, but they're freely given out if you ask. Except I don't think any Americans really know to ask. On the other hand, there are a lot of Asian people who eat at this ramen shop.
Well,
I would. Well, maybe they're neater than I am.
Biggest discovery when I was with clients in Japan at their home was watching Mr. Hasegawa eat sukiyaki. And he took the bowl and he put it right by his mouth.
Uh-huh.
And he spooned he chopsticked basically the contents into his mouth. And I realized, wow, it's only us that sit and try and figure out how to, so this is how you actually, you know, this is how you're meant to.
Well, it's not just us. It's Western world.
That's what I mean. How do you sit and look?
Yes, and you're totally right. In fact, I'm pretty good with chopsticks, not great.
It doesn't matter how good you are. I just
And the other day I had a bowl of rice topped with roast pork, and the rice was particularly separate, which Asian rice isn't always. So sometimes you can eat Asian rice with chopsticks with no problem because it clumps together. In this case, it did not, and I had a lot of and I thought, you know what? I'm going to bring the lip of the bowl to my mouth, and I did, and I shoveled it in. Nobody looked askance.
No,
As I said, half the people in this place are Asian, so they probably
and that's why they were like, "Oh gosh, it's a sensible gaijin."
And I'm always interested how different people in this ramen place are eating their ramen. I find that I don't know some Asian people take put the noodles that pick up the noodles with chopsticks and put it in their spoon, and then you just eat the wet noodles off the spoon, or actually dunk the spoon back into the broth so that the spoonful has both the noodles piled up on top and the broth. Other people just eat it with the chopsticks and the spoon for the broth, you know, separate like Western people would. So, in fact, speaking of Western people, we have a young man in our life, a Sicilian young man. I guess he just turned 20. And when he first came to the States, he could not, because he was so well-mannered, eat anything with his hands. So we went out for a barbecue, and he was cutting his spare ribs with a knife and fork, and we explained to him, you know, you don't have to do that here. You can pick it up and eat it right off the bone. And the same with fried chicken. He had a lot of trouble with this. He did it a couple times, but he really had a lot of trouble because that was not the manners he grew up with. In proper Italian manners, you eat everything with a knife and fork. And if you do have something that's eaten with the fingers, it actually has a name that indicates that. For instance, what we call crudite, raw vegetables that we dip into whatever, Italians would call pincimonio, meaning things you pincers. So eat it with your hands. And the other one is scottadita, which is burned fingers.
Mordita.
It's bony pieces of lamb that have been grilled. And the only way to get enjoy that is by eating it with your fingers. I'm sure I got the agreement on scottadita wrong. Maybe not.
So Marshall is scottadita.
Yes, I know. It's 8:02.
I can't help it. All right, then.
Of course. So, sauces and shapes, we can do more on that. But that was a real-life dilemma this week.
But solved.
What pasta to go with sautéed strips of collard green.
And you could also use escarole. Goodbye.
It was delicious. Goodbye.
Take care. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio and robinhoodradio.com on the web. Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. On the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.